Thanksgiving Day, 1600 style. Today, November 28th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. We continue our first day's series with an original pilgrim from England.
I cannot say I regret coming, for to regret anything is to doubt the will of God, and I would not question his mind. I would not search it that way. If he meant for me to be here, then here I shall be.
Also today, 5 years after saving an American soldier's life, an Afghan interpreter shares Thanksgiving with the Army veteran in Virginia. And later, a grieving mother is forced to confront her loss through a conversation with a cab driver.
And then he looked at me and he said, "On behalf of all Somalis, I ask your forgiveness." And I thought, whoa, man, what am I going to do now?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's Thanksgiving, a day when we gather with family and friends to count our blessings and remind ourselves of what's most important in life. Today, we'll join a celebration of two families who are feeling especially grateful, the Zellers and the Shinwaris. The family's friendship was forged in battle. Matt Zeller was a first lieutenant serving in Afghanistan in 2008. Janice Shinwari was an Afghan interpreter working for the U.S. Army. Zeller credits Shinwari with saving his life when he was ambushed by the Taliban. When Shinwari landed on a Taliban death list, he sought safety in the United States. But getting a visa proved to be a daunting process. Matt Zeller and Janice Shinwari, welcome. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And gentlemen, first, could you tell us about that first day when you met?
Yeah, sure. This is Matt. We met early to mid-April 2008. We met really quickly in passing. I just arrived on our small 20-man outpost, and I was introduced to Janice as one of the interpreters who worked there. And I said all of about 5 words to him, which was, "Hi, nice to meet you. Looking forward to working with you." I didn't realize that a week later he'd end up saving my life and become my best friend, and that, you know, we'd end up spending our Thanksgivings together going forward.
First time that we met each other, that was just an introduction of new unit because they were new on the ground in Afghanistan. And we just talked for 5 minutes. And after that, yeah, their unit was ambushed by Taliban and I saved his life there. And now I'm safe here. Even I didn't believe that I will celebrate the Thanksgiving with my best friend, my brother, in the United States. And this is the first time that I am celebrating the Thanksgiving Day with with Zeller and with his family. This is very nice.
Janice or Matt, explain to us the sort of circumstances with which sealed your fate as brothers.
Yeah, so this is Matt again. April 28th, 2008, my unit and I were out assessing an Afghan police outpost, making sure that it was manned, that the police there were doing their job, that type of stuff. And on the way back from that assessment, we got ambushed by about 45 members of the Taliban, so 45 versus the 15 of us. And long story short, about an hour in this firefight, I had run out of grenades and I was running pretty low on bullets. And I thought, well, okay, this might be it. I might die on the side of a hilltop in a sort of a nameless village in the middle of nowhere. And kind of right out of a movie, a quick reaction force, the cavalry coming to save us sort of at the last moment, just arrived out of nowhere. And Janice was in the lead vehicle. And I didn't know this at the time. He hopped out of that lead vehicle and I felt someone jump into my foxhole with me. And the next thing I know, before I could turn and see who it was, I heard the unmistakable sound of an AK-47 going off next to my head, and I turned, and it was Janice. I'll let him tell you what he was doing.
Yeah, when I got to the fight zone, I saw the first thing that their first truck was blown up by ID. I saw it from a far distance, and we were going to save their life. I was with the Quick Reaction Force unit to go and save their lives. When we got there, I jumped out from my Humvee, and I saw somebody was shooting his M4 toward the enemies, and he was a couple meters away from the other unit fighting against the Taliban. And I saw that that guy's alone, even I didn't know that he was Matt. And I ran to go and save that guy and bring him back from the kill zone to the safe zone. When I got close to the Matt, I saw two Taliban that they were sneaking from the behind to get Zeller alive or shoot him. And first thing I did, I shot at them and I killed both of them. And then, yeah, and from that time, when we got back to the base, Zeller assigned me as his own interpreter. And I was assigned to him and we became good friends and brothers.
Yeah, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today on Thanksgiving if it wasn't for Janice's actions that day. I mean, my brother here literally saved my life.
Janice, you served as an interpreter for the U.S. Army for 7 years. What happened after that? What made you decide to move to the U.S.?
I was in Kabul. I got a call from Zeller, and he told me that brother, he is leaving. And when their team left, Ghazni was getting worse in the Ghazni province. And literally, I found out that my name was added to the Taliban kill list. And that's why I transferred from Ghazni to Kabul City.
Yeah, so that was 2009 when Janice transferred to Kabul. And then in 2011, the officer he was working with at the time, the American officer, and I talked. We both felt Janice at that point really was in a lot of danger. And Janice also agreed the Taliban had really stepped up their efforts to try and hunt him down and his family and exact their revenge. And so early 2011, under our counsel, mine and another military officers, Janice submitted his application for his U.S. visa. We didn't think it would take the State Department 2 years and that they would literally put him through probably one of the worst emotional roller coasters I've ever heard of to get here.
Now, Matt, a guy like Janice, it just kind of seems like a no-brainer. He worked for the U.S. Army, the U.S. military for 7 years. Put himself in harm's way, and then there's a problem of some sort. What were you told the problem was, and what did people say you should do about it?
What ended up happening was Janice ultimately got his visa from the State Department. Now, to come here, Janice had to give the U.S. military at least one honorable year of faithful service. He served the military for 7, so he met that in spades. He had to be declared by the U.S. government as not to be a bad guy, and he had to prove that because of his service, he was in danger. He was able to do all of these things, you know, very easily and very, you know, with flying colors. The problem is that in order to compel the State Department to do their job, we had to go to the press to get some attention and sort of embarrass them into doing the right thing. The double-edged sword with that is that the Taliban ended up actually reading the U.S. news and saw that he got his visa and did the only thing that they had available to him at that point. They called the anonymous tip line that our embassy, the U.S. embassy in Kabul, has set up to report suspected attacks. And they said, Janice is actually a bad guy working for us.
You know that's the problem, this anonymous phone call? That's what they told you?
No, they wouldn't tell me. What they would tell me is that for reasons of national security, they're not allowed to talk to me about what actually went wrong with this case. I was a CIA officer for 4 years, and so I started digging around, talking to some former colleagues and some friends of mine who are pretty senior U.S. government folks at the State Department and elsewhere. And they're the ones who ended up sort of giving me, you know, the inside skinny as what was really going on. And it was because of that knowledge that I ultimately decided to get Congress involved. The State Department was so taken aback by Congress's anger over this that they decided the only way they could get rid of this was to polygraph Janice twice. And he passed both times, and as a result, they could definitively say without any doubt that it was just a bogus phone call. Finally, we were able to get him and his wife and 2 children their visas, and they immigrated here at the end of October.
Janice Inwari, you've been here for a little over a month now. What was your adjustment to America like?
This is a big change. The important thing for me and for my family that we are very safe here. In Afghanistan, we were not safe. My kids, they were at home all the time. We couldn't let them go out to play with the other kids. And here, my kids, they are playing with Matt's daughter every day. They are happy. They are free. They can go everywhere. It's a big difference in my life.
I know. I definitely think this is the first of many Thanksgivings that we're going to share together.
Matt Zeller and Janice Shinwari enjoying a special Thanksgiving. And gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
In Syria, government forces and rebel troops continue a bitter battle for territory. Soldiers loyal to President Bashar al-Assad say they've captured Deir Atiya, a western town near the border with Lebanon. That comes just a week after opposition fighters seized the town. Civilians trapped inside Syria remain desperate for aid. But getting relief into the country is no easy task. One group of British Muslims has found an approach that seems to work, packing second-hand ambulances with aid and driving them into Syria. The BBC's Katrin Nye traveled with one of these convoys for part of the journey.
Are you ready? Right, we're going. Get aid to Maksud. Just get your car in front of A5 and let's go.
Late night in Manchester. Five ambulances are packed with medical supplies and food.
Go.
A long journey to Syria waits.
I'll see you and get back. Bring it back safely, man. Bring it back.
Adil Mahmood is a pharmacist from Halifax and driving one of the ambulances.
Do you have any nerves at all?
Not at all, fairly relaxed. You know, when you get used to working 9 to 5, this is what life's really about.
A3, can you hear me, A3?
This is one of a number of smaller charity missions going to Syria, independent of the big aid agencies. They'll cover more than 3,000 miles through 9 countries. The convoy's leader is Kaz Jamil, a father of 3 who runs a taxi firm in Bolton.
Come on, let's get off, otherwise we're going to be staying here tonight. Come on. Come on.
A lot of people, when they know you're going into Syria, are like, wow, you're risking your life, why? And it's like, it's okay saying, oh, I feel sorry for the Syrians, but actually going there, knowing you've done something to help, when there's billions of people in the world who are not helping.
There are 14 British Muslims on the convoy, of Pakistani, Bangladeshi and Indian heritage. They feel it part of their religious duty to help other Muslims like those in Syria. One of the youngest is 25-year-old Majid from Leicester.
Do you feel like your religion makes you fearless doing a trip like this?
I don't fear anything. I only fear God. There's nothing to be scared of. What's the worst that can happen to you?
Serious injury, death, kidnap.
If we die while we're out trying to help others in the hour of need, the way we see it is we're going to go to heaven.
Shamila Zulfikar is the only female on the convoy, a doctor and mum of 4 from Manchester.
How do you make sure that everything you've brought gets into the right hands?
We deliver it ourselves. That's the simple answer. We deliver it to the end point ourselves.
After 8 days of travel, they finally make it to the Syrian border.
Tafadalu, let's go, let's go! Syria is calling!
The group head on without me. They're about to take huge risks and we could put them in further danger. They're documenting the journey themselves on mobile phones.
Assalamu alaikum. We're here at, in Syria at visiting one of the refugee schools.
Their first stop is Adana, just over the border where they get mobbed handing out sweets. 4 of the group then push further. They head into Aleppo. The dangers are so severe here that few foreign aid agencies are operating.
We went out with one of the hospital ambulance drivers and he knows the entire area. Some parts were a bit hairy.
More than a bit hairy.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
There's a sniper in the...
We ended up not very far from some of the front lines where there were snipers that were sat.
So you can see bullet holes in all of the walls. And there has at some point been an airstrike here as well.
To actually be in the thick of it. It was a little closer than I would have liked to have been. We managed to deliver the aid to the hospitals that were receiving a lot of the casualties from this front line.
So we've just had to take a slight detour. There's a roadblock over here and... That's not very good. This sniper shot wounds through those.
The team tear through sniper-lined streets to get from hospital to hospital.
You're kind of going in there in a slightly kamikaze fashion and really pushing it.
If it's written for me to die there, that's why I'm going. You know, that is not what I want to do. You know, I've got children at home, I've got family at home. But at the end of the day, if the world was doing what it's supposed to be doing, I wouldn't have to risk my life and do this.
The convoy all make it out of Syria safely. They intend to go back next month.
The BBC's Katrin Nye reporting. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. It is rare and difficult for an Israeli and a Palestinian to fall in love. There are both physical and cultural barriers that can prevent the sparks from flying, but sometimes love can be found. A year ago, two 29-year-olds met through an online dating site. One is from Jerusalem, the other from a West Bank village. Reporter Daniel Estrin brings us their story.
Well, the first chat with him was like any other chats in a dating website.
His profile said that he's in Jerusalem, and he messaged me.
He was a very good-looking man, charming, very intelligent, intriguing.
He was white, blue eyes, innocent. He was not the first Israeli I talked to, but they all had a problem with meeting Palestinian guys. Some of them, they thought it would be dangerous to meet a Palestinian guy, like maybe it's a trap or something.
We were chatting every day, getting to know each other.
And it didn't take long time to suggest meeting the next Saturday. I told him that you are in Jerusalem and I am in the West Bank, and there is a wall between us, that it's not a good idea to draw expectations, like we cannot really go far with it. But he was so excited and he really wanted it, and I also wanted it. I invited him to come to my house.
Strangely enough, it was the only place where we could meet legally.
And he met my family. They were surprised in a nice way. Like, wow, you're Jewish. He was like part of the family, you know. I don't know. We felt that they know that we have something special, but I'm very sure that they never thought that we are in a relationship. I live in a big lie, which is hiding my sexuality, you know.
I told my parents a few months after we started going out. They were very against it. They said that that I should think about myself and if I want to mess up my future with this. I was smuggling him to Jerusalem almost every week in the weekend, driving through the checkpoint in full confidence. Because the soldiers, if you look Israeli, they let you go. If you look Palestinian, they stop you and they check for permits.
Of course, he had to smuggle me because I didn't have permission to enter Jerusalem. Everything in the city was new to me. I loved meeting people and being myself with them. You know, because I have been hiding it for the whole of my life, so it's the time to use to make up those years of hiding.
It was supposed to be the first time that he would spend the night in my house. We were very excited about that. And all of a sudden we saw a police car going towards us, and the police officers went out of the car and asked for IDs. They usually do stop people in the middle of the night, usually looking for drugs. I think they were a bit surprised to find an illegal Palestinian. It was less an interrogation and more a warning, like, you can be friends, you can be whatever you want. Talk on the phone. Go to see him in his house. But why bring him to Israel? No, you can't do it. Eventually, I was released and he was taken to the checkpoint and dropped at the checkpoint to go back home. We knew that there was no other way, so I would bring him to Jerusalem again.
For me, it was basically love. Like, I didn't want to hang it on the wall that, oh, we are a Palestinian and an Israeli guys who are in love, you know. But it also made me happy to, like, that we are doing something special. At some point, I thought it would last forever.
Yeah, we broke up a few days ago. It's very confusing. I cannot really separate the situation, the political situation, from our personal situation. The fact is that I'm the one responsible for having this relationship, because if I don't come to his place or bringing him to Jerusalem, then we won't be together, and that creates a very uneven relationship. It's to affirm the power relations that we have as two sides of the conflict, to bring it to a relationship. It's not what I want to have. I don't want to reaffirm a situation that is that I'm against. We had a very big love, and that's a very meaningful thing in everyone's life. My hope is that he gained something from this relationship, and that now he believes that love is possible in his life, that new opportunities are possible. But I think it can happen only elsewhere, not here. And I really wish that he would find his way out of here.
Of course, Palestine is my country, and I was born here. But for me, my home is the place where I am myself. I really don't feel that Palestine is my home. I feel like a stranger in this place. I don't want to be confused if I broke up with my boyfriend because we just had issues, or because of the political situation. I want to be it more clear to me.
My intention is to leave the country because I had enough. Everything is against you. Everything. The law is against you. The situations of gays in Palestinian society is against you. The cultural differences are against you. Your parents are against you. This separation is so deep, and when individuals try to break it, they wear out. I'm all worn out.
This piece was supported by the radio production house Bending Borders, the Public Radio Exchange, and the Open Society Foundations. Still ahead, tracking down Jack Kerouac's Mexican Girl. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Just ahead, the story of the first Thanksgiving from an eyewitness.
I was much amazed when there should come 90 warriors, painted as they do, and it was actually rather awkward, for what should be a feast for 43 might not sell for 90 warriors.
We'll have a conversation with one of the original Pilgrim Fathers.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We thought we'd bring you a special edition today of First Days, our series that looks at immigrants' first experiences in America. Like many newcomers, this couple fled persecution in search of a better life.
My name is William Bradford. I am here their governor at New Plymouth. I come in 1620 on Mayflower. This is my wife, Alice. She come on a ship called Anne in 1623 to marry me here.
And I am very well pleased to say that from the time that I come here, which is now just a little bit more than 4 years ago, We begin to taste, I think, some of the sweetness of the country, and the town hath grown, the families have increased, and it is a peaceable place and a good place. I hope it will continue to prosper.
William and Alice came from England via Holland. As William describes it, it was, well, less than an optimal trip.
It was rather miserable, though I would rate it the second worst sea voyage I've been upon, chiefly for that fact that Mayflower was never in any danger of sinking. The journey from England to Holland was actually somewhat worse, and I learned on that occasion that if the sailors begin to pray rather than their ordinary cursing, there is truly trouble.
It was a tough first few years. There were some of the usual problems, disease, drought, and the like. But Alice says she came to love their new country.
It is a good place. It is a hopeful place. It is a home for our church, which is something that we sorely lacked. A refuge we had, but not a home. And here I can see that God has prospered us some already, and I hope he will continue to so do. I find it to my liking, this place.
It must be pretty different, though, from where you came from.
Master, it is very different from everywhere else that I have ever lived, and I have lived in a great many places for an English woman. I grew up in the West Country of England, went into Amsterdam when I was 12, and lived there for almost 10 years before our church moved over to the city of Leiden, and then lived in London with my late husband, and then back to the West Country. But this is like none of those places, I can well assure you of that. Truly, this is the wilderness. When I first laid my eyes upon this place, I imagined that what I beheld, that must be what England looked like 1,000 years ago when the Romans first arrived. And yet, surrounded on all sides by this vast wilderness, was a little town, the very beginnings of Christian civilization out in the wilderness. And I thought, here we can do God's work.
They named that little town Plymouth Plantation, in the current Massachusetts town of Plymouth. Though much too modest to say so, William and Alice Bradford helped invent one of America's best-loved traditions. That is Thanksgiving, of course, though at the time, William didn't call it that.
There was a feast that I did order in 1621, that we should have some relief after the harvest. I ordered 4 men would go out and shoot fowl, and they shot so many birds you could feed the town for near a week. I was much amazed when there should come 90 warriors, and Massasoit himself, and painted as they do, and it was actually rather awkward, for we had all of 43 people, and what should be a feast for 43 might not so for 90 warriors. Yet the natives seemed to recognize the same, and when courtesy was of course offered to them, the native king caused his warriors to slay a number of deer which were presented to the town, and I think it may have become more entertainment than we intended.
So, William Bradford, you came up with this Day of Thanksgiving. Did you intend for it to be an annual event?
I should not think so, sir. It was appropriate once, but there is no reason that there should be a Thanksgiving repeated year after year. At the time, it was simply a means of relief for all those who had worked so hard and suffered so much through that first year.
Now, Alice, I know you're very religious. Do you sing at all?
Oh, certainly. We sing in church. We will sing the Psalms, for that is the instrument that God hath given us to make a joyful noise.
Could you pick one for us and sing it?
My pleasure. Shout to Jehovah all the earth.
William and Alice were kind enough to let us film them in their town, Plymouth Plantation. You can see that video at PRI.org. When they're out of their pilgrim garb, the two are the real-life couple, Chris and Nora Messier. They both work at the plantation, a modern recreation of the first successful English colony in New England. Chris and Nora have spent years researching the lives of the people that they portray, William and Alice Bradford. We move on now to another love affair. This one lasted two chapters.
I had bought my ticket and was waiting for the L.A. bus when all of a sudden I saw the cutest little Mexican girl in slacks. Her hair was long and lustrous black, and her eyes were great big blue things with timidities inside. A pain stabbed my heart, as it did every time I saw a girl I loved who was going the opposite direction in this too big world.
That's Jack Kerouac reading from his novel On the Road. And that Mexican girl, named Terry in the book, was in real life a woman named B. Franco. More than 50 years after On the Road was published, author Tim Z. Hernandez tracked down B. Franco. In his new novel, Mañana Means Forever, Hernandez revisits the affair, and this time we hear the Mexican girl's point of view.
I discovered that there were letters at the Kerouac archives at the New York Public Library, letters that Terry or B. Franco actually wrote to Kerouac. And so I wanted to see the letters, and when I went and saw those and held them in my hand, it suddenly became real to me in a way that it hadn't before. Before, she was simply a character in my mind, and holding those letters, I realized it was a real person, and I wanted to find out more about her.
And these were letters that went back and forth between B and Kerouac after he'd gone back to New York.
Right, yeah. They wrote about 5 letters back and forth to each other until December, and that was the last letter.
Okay, so you saw the letters. What happens next? How did you continue the search?
Well, I actually ended up asking the archivist there, how do I get permission to publish these letters? And he said, you know, you have to ask her family. And I said, well, can you give me the number? Very naively, you know, can you give me the number?
And he said, what's her email?
Yeah, exactly. And he kind of chuckled too. And he said, you know, a lot of biographers have tried and no one's found her. Good luck. So I returned to Fresno, California, where I lived at the time. And very naively started looking for her. I actually hired at one point a private investigator, to no success. But certainly the private investigator, she said to me before we parted ways, she said, you know, in all of my years of experience, Tim, dead people are very easy to find. It's people who are alive that are difficult to find. Have you ever thought she might be alive? And I said, no, you know, that never crossed my mind, really. I thought I'd be looking for her children or something, you know. And
so you were looking for a dead person.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I was calling up cemeteries all in the San Joaquin Valley. I mean, I must have called, you know, over a dozen cemeteries asking for B.R. Franco, and about a year and a half to 2 years of work of research trying to find her or her family. At the end of it, I finally sort of surrendered and said, okay, I think I have enough now to move forward. I don't have to find her family. I'm just going to write the book based on what I do know. And that was when I actually ended up finding her, was when I sort of gave up. and I discovered that she lived only about a mile and a half down the street from my house in Fresno.
And how did that happen?
My mother actually was invested in the story by then. She said, you know, you can't give up looking for her. You know, I'm retired. I've got nothing better to do. Give me your files. I'll find her. And, you know, my mother, 24 hours later, called me and said, I have an address for you.
24 hours later after a nearly
yes.
two-year search.
That's right. A day later. Yep.
Describe the scene when you first approached her house.
Sure. I think it's important to put into context that, you know, what essentially her relationship to Kerouac was an affair. She was a married woman in 1947, and she was actually leaving her husband. He was an abusive man. And so, you know, when I was knocking on the door, they weren't expecting me by any means. And when I went and knocked on the door, and her daughter opened it, and I basically just started to spill my guts as quickly as I can, you know, tell the story of this whole
before
legacy.
She slammed the door in your face.
Yeah, exactly. I had to kind of get the words out really quick. And she said to me, you know, I think you have the wrong family. And my mother would have never been around those kinds of people. And she's just been here, a farm worker, most of her life. And she's been here in the valley, you know, between here and L.A. And I said, okay, well, before you kick me off your porch, let me ask you a few questions. Do you mind? And she said, sure. So I started to go down my list of questions about her family members and whereabouts of her mother in 1947. And all of that fit to a T, and it kind of scared her, frankly, because she said, well, who are you again and what's your name and can you show me, you know? And I kept telling her, I'm an author, and look at, here are my books, and, you know, I'm legitimate. And finally I said to her, let me just show you one thing here and then I'll leave. And she said, sure. So I gave her the letters. She wouldn't open the door. I had to slide them to the screen door, to the crack in the door. She finally passed the letters back to me after a few minutes, and she said to me, you know, why don't you come back on Thursday and speak to my brother Albert? The long story short is that, you know, I ended up getting to finally meet B. Franco and interview and speak with her about all of this.
So did her daughter or her son, who is mentioned in Kerouac's book, did either of them know about this?
No. They'd never heard of the name Kerouac, Jack Kerouac. No.
Wow. And so you meet B. Franco. Mm-hmm. Do you walk in and say, hey, B., what about Jack?
I did. I opened the first sort of things out of my mouth were, tell me about Jack. What do you remember about him? And it is very naive. Again, she sort of shuts down because I'm asking these questions that she's uncomfortable answering clearly. I shift gears. You know, my next visit, I just say, forget about Kerouac. I had to close that kind of door to my mind and just ask her about her life. And after all, as another author friend of mine would tell me later, you know, we know his story already. There's millions of books about him, but we don't know her story. Ask her about her story. And then she started to open up. And that's where we spent most of our time, was talking about her life.
Tim Z. Hernandez, the author of Mañana Means Heaven. A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Eldon was a talented young photojournalist when he first traveled to Somalia in 1992. He was in the East African country to document the widespread famine that was killing tens of thousands of people. Just 1 year later, Eldon was killed. Dan's mother, Kathy, has spent decades trying to make sense of her son's death. Her new memoir is called In the Heart of Life.
Dan was a vibrant spirit. He was skinny as a rail, and he had a very strong, positive personality that disarmed people. When Dan was 21 years old, he heard about a possible famine in Somalia. He went with his friend Aidan Hartley, who was working with Reuters, to explore whether there was indeed a problem there. The two of them reported and took photographs of this famine where thousands of people were threatened and hundreds were dying. The photographs that he took were harrowing, and they triggered a global response, and that response was enough to make Dan want to go back again and again for the next year to continue telling the story. There's an addictive quality to that country. It is uncertain, unstable. The people are challenging. By 4 in the afternoon, many of the young men are on khat, which is something that you chew to make you high. It was always an adrenaline boost, but I don't think that was really the reason he was there. I think for him, it was a chance to use his photography to tell a story that needed to be told about a problem that really needed to be solved. So he continued to go back. His photographs showed the really unraveling of that country and the descent of it into tremendous chaos.
Dan Eldon's young life was cut short when he was killed by the very people whose stories he was trying to tell.
On July 12, 1993, there was a bombing by UN forces under American leadership of a house where they believed a warlord was hiding. It was sort of like us hunting for Osama bin Laden. Tragically, the warlord wasn't there, and it was really a meeting of community leaders discussing the possibility of peace. During the bombing, about 72 people were killed, hundreds were wounded, and the survivors ran to the Al-Sahafi Hotel, the journalist hotel, to get help. They wanted people to come and tell the story of what had happened. They convinced the journalists to come that they would be safe, and Dan and a group of other young journalists arrived on the scene to discover a scene of terrible chaos and carnage. They started shooting pictures, but the crowd, who numbered around 1,000 in the compound, was very angry, and they became a mob and picked up stones and sticks and began to shout that the journalists were to blame, and they attacked the journalists. And 4 were killed, and 1 escaped.
Kathy Eldon has been working through her grief ever since. A few years ago, she was traveling in New York with her daughter Amy when she hailed a cab.
And when we got in the taxi, we realized that the taxi driver was Somali. Now, this has not happened to me before or since. And I thought, what do I do? You know, do I tell this guy what happened? And I just told him what had happened to my son. And I thought, I have no idea what he's going to do. He turned around, and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, my name is Mohammed, and I am so sorry for what happened to your son. He said, I know exactly what happened that day. He had a friend or a brother who had been hurt or killed even. And he said, it shouldn't have happened. And I was still kind of cold because I just didn't even know how to respond. And then he looked at me and he said, on behalf of all Somalis, I ask your forgiveness. And I thought, whoa, man, what am I going to do now? And then I thought, you know, as Gandhi said, if the world is to change, we have to change. And I was able to say, okay, I understand what the Somalis who killed Dan did and why, and I forgive them. And it was like this enormous weight off my head and my spirit. And I was able, I think, to really use my life in a much more positive way than if I'd hung on to that rage.
Kathy Eldon's son Dan died in Somalia in 1993. He was just 22 years old. Her new memoir is called In the Heart of Life. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. I'm in the Fraser Recording Studio here at WGBH to meet Canadian singing sensation Basha Bulat. Basha, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's so great to have you here. Some of the press has been calling you the new Joni Mitchell.
There can only be one. There can only be one. It's not fair. This is just, you know, she's like a genre unto herself. So I think
that it's pretty high praise, though.
It's, of course, but I'm not sure I'm worthy of that praise. I love her, obviously. You know, this is like one of the people I grew up listening to, and I feel like she partially raised me. She's in a class unto herself, of course.
Would you consider her a musical influence?
I would say an inspiration, too.
Any other influences?
Ah, there's so many. I mean, I've also been influenced a lot by the kind of writing that I've just been reading my whole life. The writers that I love, people like Alice Munro or Margaret Atwood, or a filmmaker like Sarah Polley. I guess if we're going to stick with all things Canada, there's a kind of great tradition of amazing independent women doing their own thing in Canada, which is pretty great.
Could you explain for us what was behind the song Wires on the new album?
Oh, yeah. Wires is, I guess, a song I wrote to try and literally talk myself out of negative state of mind and to try and convince myself not to hold myself back from whatever I'm feeling or whatever it is that I'm afraid to feel.
All right, let's hear a little bit of it now.
Talk me out of my lies and forgive myself for trying. Tell me to be brave tonight. And if we compare the timing, take me out of the wild. Build up my frame of mind and burn it till you're set on fire. Tell me when you cut the wires. Talk me out of this time. Open this heart of mine. Tell me when you cut the wires now. Open this heart of mine.
The first thing I thought of when you were playing here in the studio was, I got to get my kids playing piano.
Oh, my God.
did you do anything else growing up, or was it all piano, piano, piano?
I played a lot of different instruments. I actually feel like I need to practice piano a lot more.
Because you play everything, right?
I play a lot of things, yeah.
I started on piano when I was young because my mom taught classical piano. In school, I started picking up the two opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, I suppose, range. I was playing the flute in the stage band, and I was playing upright bass in the string orchestra. So it's kind of been all over the place, discovering rock and roll, or so to speak. So picking up guitar, fretted string instruments like that.
How many instruments do you play?
I try to convince myself that I can play anything if I at least well enough that I could write a song on it, but that's not true. I definitely will stay away from the violin and the oboe.
This current album was co-produced with Tim Kingsbury of Arcade Fire.
Yeah, and Mark Lawson.
And Mark Lawson. Yeah. Did that change your sound any?
I think for sure. It was really great to work with both of them. Tim had actually played bass on my second album, so we'd known each other for quite some time. And we had become good pals, and it just seemed to make a lot of sense to work with your friends who knew where you were coming from, but were also very cognizant of the fact that I really wanted to do something different, and they're the kind of open-minded, multifaceted, multi-talented people that would help me, you know, and be encouraging, and then would also have that elder brother attitude to, you know, take me out of any sort of headspace of nerves or anything like that. You know, they know when to make fun of you at the same time.
Basha Bulat, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we'll go out with Basha's song, Tall, Tall Shadow. You can see Basha's performance live for the world. It's all at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, that's it for us today. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.